Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is your host, Paul Workus, back this week with Billy Thompson. Billy, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me back, Paul.
Now, when we talked about your checkered past last week, you said that you had been at UVA, and then you did residency where?
At Wake Forest in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, the birthplace of Krispy Kreme donuts.
Did you spend some time there afterward before you came here and did your fellowship?
I did a chief resident year, and based on, back at that point in time, how in advance you had to apply for fellowships, I spent a year working as a hospitalist there.
I see. Okay. Which gives you an interesting perspective as well, doesn't it?
A little bit of empathy sometimes, hopefully, for the hospitalist or the general pediatrician just looking for help from the consultant doctor.
Yeah, I find that that everything you do brings some perspective. Colin Cowley from the cardiology division spent a year actually in our practice between his residency and his fellowship, and I think that just gives you a perspective of looking at the world from a different point of view.
No, I totally agree. Yeah, you learn more from kind of every experience. I used to spend 72 hours in a row on call as the only pediatrician in Wilkesboro, North Carolina over the weekend. And you learn a lot. Yeah,
you do. You learn a lot about yourself in the process too. Well, this week we want to talk about ITP. Now I've been practicing long enough that the name of ITP changed. Fortunately, they kept the initials. So we went from idiopathic to immune thrombocytopenia, which I think it was very nice of them to keep the same initial, because I'm not as confused that way. But the other part of it is I think we've learned a lot more about what ITP is. Now, before we get started, do you have anything that you want to disclose? Any conflicts?
No disclosures. Nope, I do not have anything to disclose.
So why do you get ITP?
As you mentioned, the name has changed over the years. I mean, ITP is a pretty descriptive name, idiopathic. At the time it was first discovered, we didn't know what caused it. Thrombocytopenia, low platelets. Purpura, big angry bruises. And, these days it's been changed to, in some literature, it's just been changed to just immune thrombocytopenia with no P at all, but ITP sticks just because it's become so ingrained in the literature. Like many things in benign hematology, ITP was originally figured out by mixing blood together from an affected person and a not affected person and seeing if it either caused the same problem or didn't cause the same problem. So when they took blood from a patient with ITP and transfused it into another patient, they saw that patient would develop low platelets as well. And, gradually over time, that led to the identification of a factor, in this case, antibodies against platelets that cause continued platelet destruction.
Now let's talk a little bit about platelets just as a basis. So where do platelets come from?
Outside of infancy, almost all platelets are made from megakaryocytes in your bone marrow. It cranks out about 10 to the 11th platelets every day.
Holy cow.
Your body is a tremendously quick platelet production and consumption machine, because platelets only last, about 8 days in your body under the best of circumstances.
And how's that regulated? Platelet count goes up and down, and platelet counts sometimes go up independent of need, right?
Sure. Certainly your platelet count, can be driven by a thrombocreatin, which is released in response to stress. So it's really common for us to get called with a child who's just had a terrible infection of some sort and has a platelet count of 700,000, that your body can increase your platelet count really, really quickly. You can see that. And then it, drops back down after the platelet count goes away. On the other hand, with ITP, your platelet count can crash really, really quickly too. And that's why it can be such a sudden presentation sometimes.
So how does it present? I mean, it can clearly be a range of presentations, some disastrous, some of them less so. What should I be looking for?
So, I mean, I think, and you mentioned, I'm sure you've seen a child like this before. I think the book on ITP is generally an otherwise healthy child. If it's a child with signs of systemic illness, fevers, night sweats, anything else that kind of worries that you're sick, you should think twice at least about jumping to the diagnosis of ITP. But a well child who develops exuberant bruising and potentially kind of mucosal bleeding and things like that. Obviously, this is something that is a comes on suddenly enough that it is tremendously scary for families and probably even the doctor that sees them initially. Because without knowing why, a child literally can kind of develop bruises all over their body overnight. Families are trying to figure out, gosh, what happened at school, or what potentially caused this? Are we safe to go out in public? But based on the half-life of platelets, really exuberant bruising all over your body. And about half of children will be limited to just cutaneous bruising, so just bruises and petechiae on the skin. Another 40% or so will have mucosal bleeding, nosebleeds, bleeding from the gums, things like that. Fortunately, a much smaller percent that present with a severe bleeding or hemorrhage.
Is it very likely that they would present with gum and nose bleeding without any sign of bruising? I mean, is bruising a constant or is it not?
Now, I think so. I think it's really a continuum, basically, of what your platelet count is and what kind of symptoms you have. If you start getting below 50,000, you'll probably have easy bruising. You start getting below 20,000, you'll probably have more exuberant bruising, big, huge bruises that pop up without knowing why they got it, why you got them. And then, kind of below 10,000, that's probably when you start getting the nosebleeds, bleeding and bleeding from your gums. So it would be really unlikely to have that without also exuberant skin bruising.
So you mentioned these kids may look more well than some of the other conditions that may show bruising. Any other historical signs or things on physical exam should lead us away from IT plus minus P?
Sure. No, so like I said, I totally agree with you. I think somebody being well is okay. If anything, that kind of contributes to family's anxiety a lot of ways, because you might have a rambunctious 3-year-old who's, trying to jump off the bed, and you kind of know that everything they touch is going to cause a new bruise. Typically, other exam findings, so lymphadenopathy typically does not occur in children with ITP. Splenomegaly, if it occurs, and it only occurs in about 10% of patients, should be very, very mild. So, no, the story of ITP, or at least kind of the acute ITP that most commonly happens in children, young children, ages like 1 to 8, is in almost exclusively otherwise healthy children.
So I have this healthy suspicion now. How do I work it up?
Sure. So I think if you got it, I think the first thing that you want to do is get a CBC and get a peripheral smear review. I think there are, in somebody that looks and smells like ITP, there's not a lot of other things that you would worry about it being, but getting a normal CBC would rule out, other infiltrative bone marrow processes like leukemia. There's always a small, we always get a handful of calls every year of somebody who they get a CBC, have low platelet counts, call us right away with ITP, and then they show up at the hospital and it turns out that they haven't peed in 3 days and had diarrhea 3 weeks ago and have HUS. So I think getting the peripheral smear to make sure there's not schistocytes is important. And then potentially getting a Coombs as well to make sure they don't have a positive Coombs and kind of other concurrent autoimmune cytopenias, which might suggest a little bit more chronic course that would be hard to treat.
And would the described course be more chronic than necessarily or not necessarily?
If you had a positive Coombs,
Yeah.
yeah, I would certainly be more worried. I'd be a little bit less optimistic in predicting to families that it would, go away and be gone within 6 months.
If it's been around for a while.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other predisposing factors? Any particular illnesses predisposed to ITP or immunizations or?
Sure. So, I mean, generally, the way that we assume ITP happens is you get exposed to something that your body has an immune response to that generates antibodies that are similar enough to the platelets that causes the autoimmune mimicry. About 60% of children will have some kind of viral illness in the month leading up to a diagnosis of ITP. There's no, not necessarily any viruses that we think are more likely to cause ITP than the others. Vaccines are the other things that are commonly blamed. There is a link between MMR and ITP. It's pretty uncommon. It's only about 2 per about 100,000 doses of the MMR vaccine. But you see that. And even in those cases, there's not a recommendation to avoid the MMR vaccine in the future. And even though there's anecdotal reports, there's no other reports of other vaccines consistently triggering ITP.
So in deciding what to do with it, so we've decided it's ITP and that it's not something else. How do we treat it? I'm guessing that since this is a condition that involves bleeding in various places, where and how much may be germane?
Sure. So I think there's two decisions that go into to treating ITP. I think the first decision is how severe you're bleeding. You know, and anybody that has progressed from just having skin-only bleeding, bruising, to having mucosal bleeding or things like that, you would want to do some kind of treatment to stop the bleeding. The other thing that I think is very reasonable to influence your decisions to treat is what is the situation and anxiety level in the household. If you have got a two-year-old that you are not sure that you can keep from not doing anything crazy over the duration of ITP, which is months, that might be a reasonable reason to start treatment. So families do not feel like they need to wrap their child in bubble wrap through the entire duration of illness.
What treatments are available?
Sure. So we've got a lot of treatments for ITP. They're not any things that necessarily shorten the duration of illness, but they can really improve symptoms by decreasing the rate of platelet clearance from autoantibodies. Steroids and IVIG are the two most commonly thought of, although NID antibodies, just like are used in the newborn nursery to prevent RH immunization, are also effective. There is no clear evidence that one is better than the other. Steroids are obviously quick, easy to use. I think we're all familiar with the side effects of steroids. You can start them on an outpatient basis as long as you see that the rest of the CBC is totally normal. And a lot of times you'll see a response within within 3 to 4 days. There's no clear evidence that one regimen or dose of steroids is more effective or better than the others in treating ITP. Doing a weak steroid burst can a lot of times see a decent response. For children that have symptoms that rebound out of that, you know, potentially doing that with a longer taper can minimize symptoms. IVIG also is commonly used to treat ITP. It works well. It might work slightly more quickly than steroids, so potentially within 24 hours or so. So in the rare children with ITP who have got a terrible nosebleed or more serious bleeding, then certainly doing IVIG would be reasonable. Downsides of doing it is one, it's expensive. You have to do it in inpatient or an infusion kind of setting. And then the scariest kind of sequelae with IVIG use in children with ITP is it's really prone to causing aseptic meningitis and the worst headache of a child's life. So when somebody gets IVIG, has a platelet count of 2,000 and comes back 2 days later with the worst headache of their life, they're invariably going to get a CT scan to rule out an intracranial bleed. So,
who needs to be in the hospital?
Historically, patients with ITP would get hospitalized a lot since it's such a scary diagnosis for families and community providers. I think there are progressively fewer indications to hospitalize children with ITP, and really the number one reason is severe bleeding. If somebody is not having, any kind of bleeding that cannot be controlled, then I think they're typically safe to be managed outpatient.
And when you say managed outpatient, how would you do that management? How often would you see them and how often would you recheck labs?
Yeah. So number one, I would make sure that I have got a good phone number for families and they have got a good phone number for me to be reached 24 hours a day and realize that even though we think that it's safe to be managed outpatient, that they are still at risk, even if we think it's slight risk for serious bleeding. So if they notice terrible headaches, if they notice nosebleed that doesn't stop, they go to the emergency department right away. But once you have that taken care of, then I think it generally comes down to, good advice for families. Avoid dangerous kind of sports trauma, roughhousing. For young ladies potentially kind of undergoing periods. Think about kind of menses control and things like that. Check CBC, maybe once a week until it's stabilized, but then, potentially kind of space things out as the symptoms improve as well. And and continuing increasing the frequency of, bruises or things like that worsen.
How long does it last on average?
In most patients, and this is for the child, who presents with acute onset bruising, it typically goes away within 6 months or so. And, upwards of 80% of children, it goes away and never recurs again.
Some become chronic though, right?
Yeah, so there is a small percentage of children that become chronic ITP. There's some things that we can kind of pick up from diagnosis that makes us more worried that children will develop a chronic course of ITP. Typically, the three-year-old who comes in with really exuberant bleeding and a low platelet count, that's less predictive than developing chronic ITP. The older you are and the more insidious onset of thrombocytopenia and symptoms, so potentially having a less severe platelet count at diagnosis, maybe in the teens, 30s, 40s, less severe symptoms, you're more likely to have chronic ITP. So, conversely, the more severe you are up front, a lot of times it suggests that the more likely you are to recover completely.
Is there anything more you should do for workup if somebody seems to be lasting longer, or if the more severe part of the illness is lasting for a longer period?
Sure. So, I think you get to a point in time, and this has been a change over the years as well, is that bone marrow aspirates are not routinely done these days in cases of routine ITP or recommended. If you have a child with chronic ITP, and that's, by definition, that's somebody with, platelet counts that have been low for over a year, doing a bone marrow to rule out other kinds of unlikely causes like leukemia and things like that is reasonable. Doing evaluation for other kinds of autoimmune diseases that can, lupus and things like that, that can present with immune thrombocytopenia is reasonable. And then most importantly is really coming up with a plan for these children for lifelong management, because it can be really challenging to be a teenager and have a platelet count in your 30s for months and months and months on end. Many of these children will have, pretty minimal symptoms from a day-to-day basis. Some of them you can, choose to treat, flares when they're needed, potentially with things like steroids and things like that. Other of them, and like I said, for a teenager that's an athlete that's being told that they can't play sports, and that's a pretty devastating thing. So I think doing interventions designed to keep their platelet count above a certain level the entire time certainly is worthwhile to discuss with families. Understandably, you're probably not going to want to have somebody on chronic steroid therapy for a long amount of time.
Right.
Historically, immunosuppressive agents have been used. Over the course of the past decade, there's a new class of medicines called thrombopoietin agonists that are first line now for chronic ITP in both children and adults, and are pretty effective and well-tolerated. It's a pill that you typically take once a day of increasing your platelet count to the level where you have to worry less from a day-to-day basis.
And in the patients who don't become chronic, who have a normal course, so to speak, what's the chance of relapse or recurrence?
So once you get out of that first 6 months, it's pretty unlikely to recur. That being said, during those 6 months, it is not uncommon at all to have ups and downs of your, being on a week of steroids, having a good response, and then having your platelet count dive back down when you're off steroids, potentially having your platelet count dive back down when your immune system gets re-stimulated again, and potentially kind of getting another viral illness. We always see a decent bit of children who have ITP or recovering, and get like a flu shot or things like that, and it just revs back up your immune system, and platelets take a nosedive again. So that's common.
Is that a non-specific revving up? Anything can stimulate it?
Reasonably non-specific revving up. Yeah, okay. There's certainly nothing about the flu shot that we think would cause ITP, but cranking up your antibody production in any way, shape, or form seems to do it.
Anything else? What have we missed?
Gosh, I'm trying to think. Typically, People are worried about risk of ITP amongst, you know, other family members, other siblings. For children with simple ITP, it is not something necessarily that we think all children are at significant risk for. If you have a family that comes in and gives you the history of this happens and all our family, the entire family has low platelets, then that is something that I would think more about why that is and consider the diagnosis of ITP as far as some of the other rare causes of autoimmune cytopenias. In the families that have the really strong history of autoimmune disease, certainly you can, you know, say that ITP being an autoimmune disease, you can see a tendency towards that, but I would worry more about underlying other autoimmune diseases in those children.
Very helpful. That's fascinating. For those of you who have questions, and I'm sure there are questions, you can send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. And we'll look forward to talking again sometime.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.